Ignition sequence start. 3, 2, 1. Liftoff. We have a liftoff.
About the show, it's like... All right. Welcome back to Pocket Science, everybody, the podcast where we explore the hard-hitting questions of Earth, existence, and the unknown. I'm AJ Perrin. With me again this week,
Nate Pinto.
And with us, a very special guest whom we've kept secret, Dr. Tim Cullinan.
Hello.
You might remember Tim from the Entropy episode, a fan favorite. That I feel like I've told you before that it was like the second most listened to or something in that realm.
Oh, wow. That's
yeah.
No pressure.
No, it's not. It's not like that's the thing is if you're not even thinking about it the first time through, you got it. You got it on lock. Like you don't have to do anything, I guess. And people will love it. That's what you get when you're a lecturer, like full time, not full time, but yeah.
Yeah. After a lot of work. Yeah. And studying and preparation and so forth. Yeah. You get to know some topics, I guess. Comparable to like a sponge almost. Like people ask me, how do you know all this stuff? And I say, well, it's kind of like how I got into this whole field of study. I just realized it's impossible for me not to remember these things. So yeah. Like I must like it. And
yeah,
so
right.
Yeah, it's just one of those things you just keep collecting. You know, movies is like the same way for me.
Yeah. Okay, so we've got some good episodes planned with Tim for the fall as well. We were kind of brainstorming the other day to name a few. We were going to do the double slit experiment, possibly. Is that right?
Yep.
And
I'm excited about possibly talking about x-rays,
yes.
Actually. Yeah, there's a lot of really cool things we could do there.
Yeah. And, of course, materials in sci-fi, because that is right. Your realm of expertise.
Yeah, that's another really cool thing we could do, for sure.
Yeah. Anyway, and the thing I was going to tell you before we started, so we've got new plans for the studio, so that corner over there is going to turn into, like, a, I don't know what they call it, like a comfy couch, like, studio vibe, so we're going to have... It's going to have like a brick wall background and then some shelves and lights and stuff and tube lights or whatever. It's going to be sick. Yeah, I think I need the couch for the posture reasons. Remember we were talking about that a couple episodes ago?
Yeah, like, now that we got cameras and so people on Spotify can see us, you got to like straighten up. And
yeah, I've got a naturally bad one and I write it off as like saying I'm tall. So I'm like, oh, naturally, nothing's built for me. I'm hunching over or whatever. But that's not the case. It's this right here. That causes the hunch in the video games and stuff, but whatever. Okay, so today we are talking about superconductors. If you couldn't tell from the title, what differentiates them from regular conductors, how they work, and future implications, like why these are such a big deal and why people are trying to crack the code on superconductors. But I think before that, of course, we have to jump into our news and brain gains. And we're going to speed through it, of course, because we want to get to the main event today. Nate, news, let's hear it.
Yeah, so... The NASA Perseverance rover, it's a mm-hmm. rover on Mars, found a potential hint of ancient microbes, so mm-hmm. potential signs of life. So they drilled a sample that contained organic material. They also have previously found some in 2014 in a different area, uh-huh. But it's very scarce, so it's only been found twice. This rock that they found has white spots with black rims,
yep.
which is iron phosphate, is what they discovered. And on Earth, there's similar patterns. And it's associated with ancient microbial life. Like you were saying last episode, it's not necessarily, doesn't mean that there has to be life.
Yeah.
But it's an interesting match.
Yeah.
So
it's like the things that are used by life here on Earth exist on Mars as well. So if there yes. was life, there it'd be able to use that area. But
exactly. So they want to eventually, after enough collection with other things, they'll bring material back to Earth and be able to test it and find out for sure. But it would be interesting to think like, well, what would the implications be of what potential life there could have been,
yeah.
if it is life.
All right, pass it over. I forget what I have.
My iPad on 1%.
Oh, man.
Against the clock.
About a month ago, China delivered the first sample from the far side of the moon. Judd and I did the episode on moons a while ago, or our moon specifically, and then all moons in the solar system. One of the conclusions we came to about our moon was that the far side geology is a lot different than the close side, and scientists don't really know why. They know what the differences are in terms of the thickness of the crust and the materials. A lot less radioactive materials on the far side of the moon. Anyway, so China returned a sample. It happened to have water in it. They have opened it up, basically a call to all scientists internationally to say, if you want to work on these samples, like, go for it. So, Tim, you have some in your lab, right? Is that the case?
Oh, I'd love to, yeah.
Dude.
But unfortunately, no.
What's the first test you're running if, like, you have that in your lab then?
Oh, gosh. I mean, considering my background, got to do X-ray diffraction.
Yeah.
Probably some kind of microscopy.
Right.
Any and all of those forms.
Nice. So, yeah, China sample on the moon. That's the big one. And then the second one is the Boeing Starliner is still at the International Space Station. Launched June 5th for a 10-day mission. It's now been over 50 days. And I did think it was funny because people on our Instagram, when we would post about it, would be like, they're not stuck. They can come back anytime they want. I'm like, you just have to accept it. Like, they are. And things go awry, and that's okay. Like, it's not... That's why they have these tests. This wasn't an official flight yet. This was still part of their, like, test flight program. This is the first manned test flight. But that's okay. It got stuck, and that's whatever. The problem right now is that Crew 9, Dragon Crew 9, the next SpaceX crew that's going to take people up to the space station, is happening, like, mid-August. And there's two ports on the ISS. One of them right now has Starliner. One of them has the old Crew 8 Dragon, right? And so they have to decide how they're going to free a port up for Crew 9. And the problem is right now, if SpaceX likes to have some overlap between Crew 8 and Crew 9, or any crew, because they want to have the kind of a seamless trade-off of astronauts, so they're never leaving the space station like completely bare or empty, so there's always like hands there to help out. Mm-hmm. So that means they can't really undock the old Dragon module, so they have to say goodbye to Boeing. And the question right now is, are there going to be astronauts on board when they let that go? And I guess I don't really know the answer to that. And the funny thing is, this episode will come out in about just over 2 weeks, meaning there'll probably be a huge development. And we're speaking the future into words right now. So I don't know. There's some room to predict something, but
that's really cool. I kind of had my head in the sand this summer. You know, I'm on summer break. And yeah. It's like loosely following that. So it was a great recap.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, no, absolutely. They did some hot fire. Nate, the iPad's still here. I don't need it anymore, but, they did some tests on the thrusters. That was a big thing. Actually, if you open it up real quick, I'll say the exact problems they were having. Let's see. There were some Teflon seals that were bulging because they were getting hot, and so they were expanding, and that was restricting the flow of propellant. I don't know about you. Probably important to have an adequate amount of propellant going, especially when you're trying to enter the orbit or enter your descent to Earth correctly timed, right? Because you want to land in the spot you said you were going to. So that's a problem. Second one is there was some helium. There's a helium system with seals, which had degraded because of exposure to propellant vapor, which is incredibly hot, this vapor. And so it's going to degrade the helium and cause a leak. That helium leak has been probably the most well-documented problem here. So they got some issues, but they did some tests today that are saying the thrusters are good. But I don't know about you, but I just don't see these astronauts going home on this. I think they're going to stay up there, and they're going to have to send a second. They're going to throw the Starliner off the port, and then when Crew 8 leaves, they're going to bring something up else to catch the other astronauts. I don't think it's too soon. It'd be like too risky. It would be not very NASA to say good to go.
I'm giving you this look because both of you have been through my class, right?
Yeah.
So how many times did I say thermal expansion is going to be one of like the biggest and most frequent problems for engineering? And like, there's a great example, right?
Yeah.
Like, unbelievable. It happens all the time. Like even in mundane things and indeed in like sophisticated things as well.
How hard can it be to keep the hot stuff over here and the not hot stuff over here? But when you're trying to jam it into this like cost effective when it's a $1.5 billion spacecraft, they're trying to do whatever they can to keep this system very this complex system very like combined. But
that thermal expansion is not the only consideration, right?
Yeah.
So like finding the material that just happens to be good enough at like these things, we think, and then we find out maybe not like in this area.
Yeah, that's the state of Boeing Starliner. It's who knows what's going to happen, but probably when this episode comes out, like Crew 9 has to be getting close to coming up, so they'll have that decision by then, and we'll see. The other thing that is that complicates this is the Falcon 9s, which often launch Crew Dragons, went on a FAA like kind of stop for a while because SpaceX regularly launching Starlinks right now. I don't like Starlink, and we'll do an episode on it. It's kind of a wishy-washy like legal sphere, and I don't know. I think it's not cool. We'll do an episode on it. But so they launch Starlinks all the time. They launched a recent parade of them. However, they got released. There was some oxygen leak or something, and they got launched at the wrong orbit, and eventually they fell out of orbit and came down to Earth, burned up, right? But they got released in the wrong orbit. Huge problem, because then that means any spacecraft in that orbit have to account for, oh, now we got to make some evasive maneuvers. And you're shaking your head here, Tim, because it's like, what the...
You know, I'm sick of space junk.
Yeah, me too. We did an episode on it, actually. I say that all the time at this point. We've done a lot of episodes, but yeah, I'm sick of space junk too. And if those are released into the wrong orbit and crash into something, huge problem. The FAA was like, pause on the Falcon 9s for a little bit. Like, you're on probation, essentially. SpaceX did a really quick, like, push to say, no, no, we're good. Like, here, we'll do some tests, whatever. And so now I think they're if they're not ready to fly again, like, they're getting close to it. But that was complicating it more because that meant Starliner was our only way up and down because SpaceX was saying no to the Falcon 9s. Anyway, the whole thing's crazy. Can't believe it's taken Boeing 4 years longer than SpaceX. At first, I was like, you got to give them some credit. I don't want to ride this whole, like, hate Boeing train because it just seems like the pendulum swings both ways. Sometimes Boeing has the problem. Sometimes other companies do. But clearly, there's something going on, and they need to get their act together a little bit. So best wishes to the astronauts on board, though, that are in that tough situation. I would not be very pleased if it's been five times longer than the original mission. Because you know they're not, don't have that much to do up there, probably.
Yeah, can you imagine just kind of being that, like, fifth wheel?
That's what you feel like.
50 days.
Yeah,
you just trying to be, like, helpful, but, like, not in the way.
Can I help you out here? And it's like, can you just back off here? Yeah. Like, I know what I'm doing.
Breathe a little less and go over there. Yeah.
Yeah. Can you breathe quieter? Yeah. Okay, you're taking up too much of the oxygen. We only got so much on board. Anyway, let's jump into the episode. Brain gains.
Brain gains.
Okay.
Okay, mine's a little deep, but we can keep it surface level.
Keep it surface level.
So I have a friend who goes to University of Washington,
mm-hmm.
and he's a physics major, and, like, he really enjoys quantum physics. Mm-hmm. Shout out Henry Bayard, by the way. I told you I'd give you a shout out. So I'm using you.
There it is. Yeah, go for it.
But anyways, so there's a contradiction right here. I'm here to pick your guys' brain. Basically, there's this idea of matter, antimatter, asymmetry. So we know that the universe is predominantly matter, but
matter and dark matter, I'd say. Yeah.
Yes, but we see matter or experience matter more so.
In our local area.
Yes, yeah. in the local
We can
area.
Land there. Yeah.
Right. So the thing is, when enough energy is forced together, matter and antimatter create it in pairs when you force enough energy together.
Okay.
Controversially, when matter and antimatter come in contact, they annihilate into pure energy. So the big question is, why do we live in a matter-dominant universe? There has to be some breaking of the conservation law somewhere. So basically, like, if any antimatter touch matter, so if antimatter
energy
were to touch us right now,
yeah,
we would be erased. We'd turn into energy. You have any thoughts, Tim?
You know, I'm really excited. I love all that stuff, but it's physics. It's, like, really physics, and it's just outside of my, like,
comfort zone.
Yeah. It's stuff that, like, I'll see a headline, I'm like, oh, I should look into that. And then I got stuff to do, and I kind of go back down my own rabbit holes. But I love all that, developments in all that area, yeah.
We'll do an antimatter episode, but that's kind of my, like, catchphrase almost on this show is, we'll talk about it eventually. I said last episode, you pull on the sweatshirt string that just keeps going. Mm-hmm. It's like, you can know surface level, and then you can ask one more question, and then you're lost, you know?
Yep.
Thank
you.
This one's especially for Tim, actually. Since you're a professor, I want to just let you know that it's not possible to give a surprise exam. If you say, hey, next week there's a surprise exam on Monday, Wednesday, or Friday. That is a paradox, and can I tell you why?
Okay, yeah.
Okay. So first of all, Friday. Could you give a surprise exam on Friday? No, because it's the last day of the week. And so, you know, if it didn't happen on Monday or Wednesday, it has to happen on Friday, right?
Correct, yeah. By deduction at that point. Yeah.
Right. Now, if you want the surprise test to be on Wednesday, as soon as your students show up on Monday and the exam isn't on Monday, it couldn't have been a surprise on Wednesday because you know it's not Friday. So there's no possible way now for the surprise to be on Wednesday. Huh. And so you're left with only Monday could be the day that's a surprise.
But you just told them.
But that, you have basically just told them that it's on Monday. This surprise can only be on Monday.
That's actually really interesting. Very clever. Whoa.
Yeah. I was looking up paradoxes, like supposed to be sophisticated ones about the universe or whatever. I was on Quora, which is the place.
Of course, yes.
If you're a Redditor, that's
where do you
fine.
Think I get my exam questions?
Really? Okay, you heard it here. Head to Quora. No, it's like Reddit has some good stuff, but Quora is where you get lost. Like, you enter the door at Reddit and then you end at Quora.
Normally I just bypass Quora and I'm scrolling through the results.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, now I've heard that ChatGPT is going to release a search engine. So basically, instead of Google where you search and you get your list of results, it's just like condensed into your one answer there. So if you ask best sushi places in New York, it's going to be like, this is the best sushi place in New York. Like, go here. Here's where it's located, whatever. So, like, filter through the ads and the useless information and get to that point. So,
wow, that was like a 2-in-1 brain gain.
Anyway, brain gains and news are done. I'd say a break, but I would love to just jump right into this. So we're here to talk about superconductors. But for all those unfamiliar, maybe a good place to start is conductors.
I guess in the realm of electrical behavior, there are a few different categories that materials sort of conveniently fall under, at least many materials do. And we're just based on our everyday lives, we're kind of familiar with some of these. So if you're familiar with the term conductor or insulator, or a material that is conductive, when we say that in everyday language, most people most of the time are referring to a material where the electrons that are present are able to move pretty easily in regards or in response to a stimulus. That's usually voltage.
Yeah.
Voltage is kind of the thing we do. It's like the cause. Mm-hmm. And then the effect is like a current. A material that offers the capacity to convey current, yeah. We would call that a conductive material.
Sweet.
And so that's a little bit of, I guess, maybe a poetic way to say that.
Yeah.
But,
so conductors, the electrons move easily. Insulators restrict the flow of electrons.
Yeah. And in the case of insulators, a classical insulator is the material where there really just aren't a whole lot of electrons available to move in the first place. In metals and alloys, the electron structure is such that there are a lot of electrons that are we call free or delocalized. They are not really associated permanently with any one atom. They're able to, many of them, not all of them, but many of them are able to kind of move around freely. That's just not the case in the types of materials that are known to be insulators. So if you break down as an umbrella term insulators, you're going to find in that listing things like ionic materials, covalent materials, where the bonding is such that the electrons that are there, they're tied up in some way. In a covalent bond, they're being shared between two nuclei, and they don't really want to leave. Like, that's the whole point, is the atoms that bonded in that way are happy. They've got their octet for the most part. Like, there's a couple exceptions.
Yeah.
But in ionic materials, it's that there was this permanent transfer of electrons that gave rise to ions. And that's really a stable, relatively stable configuration for those elements in their electron configuration. They don't want to go back.
Yeah.
And so it's the case that for those very strongly bonded materials, against those that are covalent or ionic dominated, we find that they're very strong, very brittle for, you know, again, reasons that go back to the bonding, but also they lack this high concentration of free electrons. And so just to give you a sense here, a typical number or a typical way to think about this is in a good conductor, like a metal, copper or something, you're going to get about 1 to 2 free electrons per atom. And if you know anything about matter, solid state matter, you know, think about like how much volume a mole takes up in your hand. What would you say? Like, what's a typical
dice?
Volume?
Is
about the
say?
Size of a dice. Like, it's in that in that realm, right?
Yes.
So it's in that realm. And so basically you have about a mole-ish of free electrons per centimeter cubed.
Like, yeah.
It's a lot.
Yeah.
But you have nowhere near that number in the materials that bond in the other ways, where the electrons are kind of tied up in those other types of bonding.
Yeah. We're at the point where we know the difference between a conductor and an insulator. For those conductors, there is a property that, for the most part, in electronics is not so great. And that property is resistance. As electrons move through a metallic lattice, essentially, in those conductive materials, they're going to lose energy because they bump into stuff.
It is problematic. And this is something that I always stress to students, is that resistance is an object property. What we would love to have, if possible, is a number that, like, no matter what, it's always true for that material, regardless of its shape, its volume, its aspect ratio, anything like when you machine it into a shape. We don't want a property that's dependent on those things. So it's true that objects have resistance. The property that I think you're referring to is resistivity, which is the inherent material property that's going to describe the material's tendency to disrupt electron motion, right?
Yeah.
So to block electrons, scatter them, et cetera. Yeah, resistivity.
So naturally, as electrons flow through a metallic lattice, the colder that material is, the less resistance you're going to have because those electrons are moving around less and having less collisions. Would you say that's true?
When you say moving around less, I would say they're moving around better is what they're doing.
With less vibrations,
maybe? With less scattering.
Yeah, okay.
Less scattering is happening. But they're moving like towards the the finish line. So we could use an analogy. So like if you're going to run a race, like there's a start and a finish and everybody basically goes the same way, right?
Yeah.
And so we're not allowing for the possibility that all of a sudden the whistle blows and people are going to turn around and go the other way.
Yeah.
So they're going one way. All the electrons generally are going to be going one way. But we say generally because in typical materials, there are what we call scattering sites. And in other words, it's not a perfect path for any one electron. Like, they're going to bump into things. They're going to bump into atoms. They're going to other electrons. Yeah. They're going to bump into crystalline defects, which, you know, we can go down that rabbit hole if you really want to, but like, there's any number of those. So a few that might be easy to think about would be impurities. Uh-huh. So like I said, think about something simple like pure copper. Well, what we might consider pure copper for a human, in reality, you zoom in, you're going to find a few random elements in there tucked in there. That's a different environment. And an electron that's expecting like, okay, aluminum, 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 and bam, there's a copper here. Whoa. And it has to kind of move around. That's a mm-hmm. scattering event. And those tend to slow down the electrons. So what they end up acquiring is what's called a drift velocity. It's kind of like pinball, right?
Okay.
So they have very fast speeds between these collisions, but the net speed down the board of the pinball machine is kind of slow, right? If all you could see was not like the two-dimensional velocity in between, but if you could just look maybe from the side and all you could see is its position, you're not the player, but you're a friend kind of watching just from the side. All you can kind of see is how fast the ball is moving up and down the table. It doesn't seem like it's going very fast. Mm-hmm. But if you look top down, it's going like crazy between these things. Yeah. Right.
So when we measure current, we're looking at the net just linear.
Yeah. A current measurement is a measurement of the drift velocity.
Okay.
Yeah.
What are some ways that we can decrease resistance, right? We talked about temperature.
Right. So just in case, that's resistivity and resistance both are kind of pessimistic. So for those out there that are optimistic, if you take the reciprocal, that's conductivity, and you can just reverse the arguments and it'll hold. So, and yes, it turns out that to a degree, if you drop temperature, you tend to lower resistivity, therefore improve conductivity, allowing for the electrons that are there, these free electrons in like a metal or something, to move more effectively. You're reducing the scattering frequency overall. Let me ask you, what is temperature even? Like, what's temperature even a measure of? What does like a 500 degree material have different than 1,000 degree Kelvin in terms of the atom's motion?
I would say like random vibrational motion.
Yeah, it's the oscillations. It's the oscillations of the atoms, right? So we like to think often about materials where the atoms kind of sit in their one spot and like that's it. But they're moving. They're moving mm-hmm. very, very fast. In fact, they're moving at like, even like at room temperature, they're moving at terahertz frequencies.
Wow.
Like 10 to the 12 cycles per second. It's insanely fast. What we often see in pictures and textbooks are like the time averaged positions. Okay, we'll stick to the particle version. We can get into this rabbit hole on the double slit. But if we think about electrons as kind of small particles, small mass, small size, they're going to get bumped by like these oscillating atoms that are in this lattice. At the addition of impurities kind of creates this, I should say, it makes the path a little bit less predictable, if you will, for the electron. And so it might be zooming along just fine, and it's out of the way of some of these other, like whatever might be aluminum, but then this copper's there, and it's got a slightly different oscillation, and that's just enough to cause this scattering. It's just a little bit different than the pure aluminum. As we lower temperature, kind of regardless of what that composition is, you are taking away thermal energy, you mentioned energy earlier, that is giving rise to these oscillations. So you're making their amplitudes and their frequencies lower. So the chances of scattering are lowered for like two reasons.
So how do we get from lowering temperatures to this idea of superconductivity? And what is superconductivity?
It turns out that for many like standard, typical like conducting materials, metals and alloys, not all of them, but many of them, you lower their temperature, and people knew about this. You can lower their temperature. We see improved conductivities. You would think, okay, we'll keep going. And often there's this situation where it just kind of saturates. Like it's very low. And it just kind of like seems like it's close to zero. But, you know, if you keep going to the limits of measurement, there's just this like just this finite small amount of what we call residual resistivity. Well, there are materials that just do something very different. And it's pretty awesome. And so what they do is they show, instead of just kind of this gradual asymptote to a constant value, they just plummet. They literally just plummet to a zero resistivity.
Yeah.
Which implies infinite conductivity.
And that's at what they call a critical temperature.
And so when we see material properties in general change in some very dramatic way, numerically or qualitatively even, about some value, yes, we give that the term critical. And so the critical temperature in this case, because there's some other critical properties we'll get to, the critical temperature in this case is an important thing. And if you're above that, you're just kind of normal and boring as a material. You're just doing what you're doing. But as soon as you get below the critical temperature, when you cool it down, if it's the appropriate material, like one of these known superconductors, yes, it starts to behave in a very interesting way. The resistivity vanishes, is what they say. So the conductivity goes to infinity. So it's a perfect conductor.
Right. And this was first discovered in 1911, this guy cooled mercury down to negative 452 Fahrenheit, so which would be almost absolute zero or zero Kelvin.
Like 4.2 Kelvin.
4.2.
Yeah, okay. So basically all the way to absolute zero, and that's where this first first observation of that critical temperature or that in that conductivity going to infinity first occurred. But the interesting thing is that wasn't even explained, that phenomenon wasn't explained for another 50 years. So that first happened in 1911, but we went over five decades without being able to say why. So we were at this point where you could literally hook up a power supply to this cooled mercury, run a current through it, and if put it in a loop, take away the power supply, come back at that point, maybe even five decades later, and be like, oh, look at that. It's still running that current.
Yeah. And so it's like basically free conductivity, but I'm using like air quotes because
you couldn't attach
anything
to it.
Because you need to, one, if you start running a load, there's going to be this dissipation over time. But then you're also, somebody's paying, it's no free lunch. You're paying for the cooling, right? So yeah. Like it's not totally free, but
can you write that down?
Just the context of the electrical behavior, it's free conductivity. You don't have any of these scattering events like you had in the classical model above the critical temperature.
The funny thing to me is that this guy who cooled it down to negative 452.
Or 4.2. 4.2 Kelvin. Oh,
Fahrenheit.
You're in Fahrenheit.
Yeah.
Barbaric units. What are you doing?
Dude,
who in their right mind thinks about cryogen temperatures in Fahrenheit?
Don't look at my notes, goodness. We're going to go from Fahrenheit to Celsius to Kelvin to like,
I'm like 450. I'm like,
that's
like a high temperature. What the
yeah,
heck?
No.
And
there's no negative temperatures in Kelvin. But yeah, so the guy who cooled it down to 4.2 Kelvin earned the Nobel Physics Prize in 1913 without being able to say why it happened. They were like, you know what? This is pretty cool. Not going to lie. So they gave him a Nobel Prize. And what we'll find as we go through the rest of the episode is that superconductivity has actually won a total of five, pretty significant when it comes to just one topic of recurring. There's been crazier topics such as X-rays, which right, I know is what you're thinking of.
Yep. So that I had like three things to say. That was one of them. I'm already going to forget the other two. But yes, X-rays, quick interlude advertisement for an upcoming episode. There's a significant number of physics and chemistry prizes related to X-rays, which is why I want to talk about them later. Yes, that might be. You said 1913,
mm-hmm.
So 1911.
Okay. 1911.
I'm gonna take your word on that. That's got to be one of the fastest turnarounds for a Nobel Prize.
Yeah.
Also,
usually it's much longer. But I guess.
Right. I mean,
what else is happening besides
1911? Incredible that they realize how like important that was going to be, and how that would open the door for a lot of really cool things.
Yeah.
This other thing I was gonna say. We have to complete this thought. So the definition is not complete. So rewinding, we were talking about this vanishing of the resistivity.
Mm-hmm.
That alone, that first prerequisite, describes what's called a perfect conductor.
Mm-hmm.
But we need another thing in order to qualify as a superconductor. And this might surprise a lot of people. And it's about magnetic behavior.
Mm.
The other criterion that has to be met is that there has to be a Meissner effect displayed. So what's the Meissner effect? The ability of the material to completely expel any applied magnetic fields that come into proximity. If you have like this, let's say, puck or piece of superconducting material, you try to bring a magnet close to it, you can't. Like it will literally force you away. And so if you've seen these pictures of like magnets levitating on like a chilled dish, and there's this like...
They're pretty typical picture for superconductivity.
These are a great party trick for like Maddie recruitment.
I thought you were saying just for me. I was like, I don't carry liquid nitrogen in my pocket.
I kind of gestured toward you. Yeah, that was just kind of like making sure.
That'd be sick if I had that to pull out.
Side note, that was like the one time I broke an Elmo, the like projection equipment at our institution, I'll say.
Too cold?
Yeah, it was too cold. It thermal shocked. So at any rate, the statute of limitations on that is
far
expired. Yeah. Sweet. So we're good. But at any rate, yeah, this is a common demonstration that's done, and certainly in physics and material science, is to put like a small piece of superconductor in like a little dish, you cool it down with liquid nitrogen, and you'll float a magnet on top. And it's pretty incredible. I mean, it's like, you know, if you didn't know, you'd think it's magic. And it's totally this superconducting phenomenon. It's really awesome.
So I've got two questions about magnetism before we might move on in the interest of time. I love saying that. That's like a very radio thing, in the interest of time. Anyway, magnets induce electric currents, and electric currents give rise to magnetic fields. Is that how this idea of the repelling propagates? Like, how does that? Okay, so you said it completely repels all magnets. Like,
that's,
how
that's
does
kind
that
of the
happen?
Black box effect. Yeah. So what's going on? So it's this delicate dance between Faraday's law of induction and Lenz's law. Mm. If you have this change in magnetic fields, you tend to see induced currents. And then with induced currents that themselves produce magnetic fields, there's this tendency for an opposing magnetic field to develop. And that's the Lenz's law part. And so you might have seen Lenz's law at play, or both of these kind of similar laws at play. If you like drop a magnet down a copper tube, you'll see that it'll like kind of slowly fall through. It doesn't fall through at like typical rates.
Yep. That's a very typical demo.
Yep. And so if you put it through a material that's not capable of producing those induced currents, like a PVC pipe, it just falls straight through at, typical falling rates. So in these superconducting state, they're doing that like perfectly. So here's the real thing that might surprise you. Superconductors are perfect diamagnet materials. So you may have heard of dielectrics, just kind of as a similar term. Diamagnetic materials are those that permanently or perfectly expel these magnetic fields that try to come nearby because of the induced magnetic field that cancels. So similar to, by analogy, you could have waves that are out of phase and they appropriately align and they can cancel to a net zero amplitude. It's a similar idea over in here in this case. I had a thought, now it's gone.
I got, maybe this might induce it, no pun intended. So nice. There's low temperature superconductors, and then there's...
Oh, I know what I was going to say, sorry.
No, go for it.
There are limits to that, and we can
That's
talk about that.
That's what I was going
to. Okay. Wow, we're like, I can't even
In
believe
sync.
That.
Yeah. The waves are
aligning.
I know.
That's great.
Is this effect for like these very low temperature superconductors to repel magnetic fields? Does that happen for all... is there...
All field strengths?
Yes, exactly.
No, I mean, only up to like about a few Tesla, single digit Tesla of magnetic fields. So yes, nice. There's a limit, meaning if you go too high, the field ultimately does penetrate. But like, I mean, two Tesla, like, let me ask you, is that a small field or a large field?
I mean...
Is that significant?
Like, it is, yeah. So so for like a permanent magnet, like for those...
Fridge
magnet, or neodymium iron boron, you can buy these like strong magnets that you come ship in the mail or whatever and you get like a set. They have Teflon, typically some kind of polymer in between so that you can actually separate them more easily.
Yeah.
Because once they're stuck, like, especially the small ones, it's really difficult. You have to like get a
prying,
some kind of like thin sheet of plastic to kind of break them apart. Yeah. And they're really strong. Now that's really strong, but those are nowhere near a Tesla.
Oh, wow.
So like a upper limit for like a typical, like hard magnetic material, that's kind of a buzzword for us. That's a material that is made specifically to be strong and magnetic. They're not coming close. I mean, like some of them you could get, but you're going to pay a lot of money and it's going to be kind of a specialty thing to get in that Tesla range. So a superconductor, now this gets into another thing. There's type one, type two.
Yeah.
And so type one, it turns out, has a lower bound on the limit for how far you can push that expulsion of the magnetic field. And it's around a few Tesla. Again, that's ballpark. But type two can go up to, dozens. And so that dozens of Tesla is like insane amount of field. If you go to get an MRI, like a typical ballpark like field, and that people know like that's a magnetic instrument and like there's a lot of magnetic field and stuff. That's like in the 5 Tesla range, right?
So it gets stronger. Okay.
And those use superconductors, right? Like when we're talking actual whole number Tesla a field, it's a lot. Like that's a huge
double
amount of
digits
field.
Is
yes,
insane.
Yes.
Before we get into type one, type two, I think I have two more objectives for the episode, which would be to talk about first, like a very bare bones explanation of the quantum explanation for the superconductivity phenomenon, and then we can maybe go into the huge applications for superconductors and the push in research right now for
I think we could wrap type one and type two into applications.
In 1957, I said 50 years after that first introduction of superconductors is when we finally started to explain this effect. And now to Tim's earlier point, like usually it takes a long time for the Nobel Prizes to roll out. This Nobel Prize came in 1972. Leon Cooper, Robert Schieffer, something like that, and John Bardeen, They came up with something called the BCS theory, which was their explanation for low temperature superconductors. And what they found is essentially that like the easiest explanation of it is electrons normally repel one another, right? Mm-hmm. But as electrons move through one side of the material to the other, they distort the positive metallic ions within the lattice.
Yeah.
Now, this distortion, as the electron pulls, you know, kind of these positive ions closer, is going to create kind of a larger net positive charge in one area, which is going to attract other nearby electrons. These electrons essentially become paired up in what are called Cooper pairs, which allow them to exist at the same energy state, which normally wouldn't be possible.
Yeah, I want to add on maybe the way that at least I like to think of it is almost like a tunnel, and we have these protons on as like the walls of these tunnel. And so as an electron goes through, naturally with charges, the protons start to close in a little bit with that attraction to the electron. And so what that does is, like you were saying, it creates that positive what was the word you used to describe it? Like the
distortion or displacement or something like that?
Yeah, where there's a higher positive charge there. So it'll pull another electron to it or a little bit closer to where the magnitude of the positive charge is enough to keep the electron close to where it negates the repulsion between the two electrons. And so with just the kind of contracting of that, we'll say proton tunnel, it kind of keeps this Cooper pair together and they flow together. And you start to stack that up in this lattice and then they start to flow together.
Yeah, I think this is a really great starting point. And it might be helpful for those that are listening to maybe just visualize just like even a single like row of just some atoms. And we have atoms made up of, as you mentioned, protons in the middle. Like they're all there. So there's quite a bit of positive charge in the middle. And yes, we have the surrounding electrons that are not bonding and so forth in those electron shells. And then you have, for whatever reason, you'll have these free electrons, which are the ones that are traveling that you're both mentioning. And so those traveling free electrons, if you think about them, like just two of them, one on either side of this kind of row of atoms for now. And this is the key here, and we've been talking about this before, we got to get to a low enough temperature for this phenomenon that you're explaining to occur. And the reason is temperature is, well, let's go back. What you were mentioning was distortion. You kept using that word. And so distortion of what? It's not so much the distortion of a given atom's shape. What it is, it's a distortion of this like line. There's like, instead of being perfectly straight, an electron coming by has a little bit of a pull. It's going to have a little pull on the protons in a nearby atom, and it will pull that atom that's in proximity a little bit out and distort that atom's position relative to its neighbors as if it were in a perfect line. And so what that does, going back to what AJ said, is it kind of creates this locally slightly greater positive location because atoms are bonded, so even the neighbors are going to slightly distort. But here's the thing. So temperature ruins everything. Temperature is ruining this effect when you're above the critical temperature.
Because
it's too high of amplitude and frequency. So think about this. The electron, the small, you know, meager electron having some kind of influence over moving an atom within this lattice, that's going to get drowned out if you've got the noise of temperature, like too high of temperature, right? Mm-hmm. So at room temperature, we're way too high for this phenomenon in the materials that we know of right now. It's just too chaotic. And so for this very delicate effect to occur, we got to get down to these low temperatures where the thermal oscillations are small enough that we can now overcome that through this direct electron and proton cluster, the nucleus, distortion. Yeah.
So if we're decreasing the temperature a significant amount to where we minimize these oscillations of these atoms or the protons, I guess, specifically, do we not look at a slowing of the electrons then as well? Or because they're so small, does the temperature not affect them as much?
It's a good question.
It's a great question, yeah. And I don't want to make a comment on like the... Remember how we talked about like instantaneous... Yeah, instantaneous velocities, drift velocities. Mm-hmm. Yeah, certainly there's some things we could probably say there. I'm not prepared to make a comment on that right now. They're really fast. Fast, even at these low temperatures, yeah.
I think a nice way I heard it explained about temperature ruining everything essentially is these electrons, when they pair up, they act a little more like something called a boson. So electrons are typically described as what's called a fermion, which without getting into the quantum stuff, basically means that they can't get in sync with each other. They can't exist in the same kind of state. They oppose each other in different ways. But as a boson, which is how they behave once they form these Cooper pairs, they can drop into the same energy bracket. And at these low temperatures, they drop into essentially the lowest energy state. Mm-hmm. And now in this low energy state, they have essentially, they have no energy to give, essentially. They're at their lowest, they're at their lowest spot. So they have nothing, no resistivity or no energy to be lost. However, when you increase that temperature, that can be enough to kick them out of that low energy state and into no longer acting like a boson.
So it's a very weak pair that adding just a little bit of.
Oh yeah, compared to just, you know, room temperature, it's incredibly weak. So that's why we have to get to these.
Have you guys ever experienced like liquid nitrogen at all?
Experienced it?
Like had it on you?
Oh yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I had something when I was a kid or something. I had to get some stuff frozen off. Not like warts or anything,
yeah,
but just
sure.
like
yeah, oh, yeah, yeah.
And you go to the dermatologist and they
cryogenic. Yeah, yeah.
It just feels like kind of like a shot or something like that because it's so cold.
And that's 77 Kelvin. And yeah, again, sticking we're talking like for the first discovery, it was down to 4.2. They had to get to. So I mean, very, very cold. But I wanted to add a little clarity too. So we talked about, you know, this line of atoms, and we have an electron that's moving along and it's exerting this little influence. Well, the pair comes along when on maybe like the other side or nearby, but on the other side of that line, there's an electron that now starts to sense this other, the two electrons are sensing each other. Mm-hmm. And so they have generally, you know, same charge repulsion. They will also do something interesting is they will make sure that their spins are opposite, even if they weren't before.
Yeah.
They will make sure their spins are opposite so that they can, you know, to satisfy some quantum mechanical rules. They're kind of entangled at that point. And as you mentioned, this is just two, you know, this extends. You have all these pairs that all occupy this low energy state. And that's just very atypical. I mean, that's atypical even in the realm of like quantum descriptions of materials. And so a lot of bizarre things happen.
We maybe alluded to this a little bit earlier, but at some point along the line between 1911 and now, we developed what is better known as high temperature superconductors.
1987.
We kept pushing that barrier of how low we need to go to have some material achieve superconductivity. And the interesting thing is superconductivity isn't as like rare as most people think. About half of the elements in the periodic table can exhibit low temperature superconductivity.
57, actually, to be precise.
57?
Okay, this number 57 is interesting because it's the year they
discovered it.
They explained the, right? So that's the year my dad was born.
Okay.
In 1987, fast forward, I was born, and that's when the first high temperature superconductor
came out. So you guys are in sync with superconductivity.
So as I was reading through this, and then you just said 57 elements, I'm thinking, oh man, these are like, this is kind of blowing my mind a little bit. So I'm terrible with dates. So I was reading through some of this to prepare, and I was just like, holy cow, like that's just a perfect way to remember. Yeah. Yeah. So in the span of, you know, that 30 year period, my dad being born and me is when, you know, from explanation and first theory to, you know, the high temperature case being produced and measured. So kind of cool.
I think we should jump into basically like the huge applications. Why do superconductors matter? Why even talk about this in the first place? What is the question that needs to be answered now in order to grant us some insane power?
Right. So there's a couple things that jump to mind. So it goes back to the definitions. So we have at our disposal here, we have perfect conductivity. So just thinking about the applications there, we can move electrons, we can create currents for basically free. Now, I remember we said earlier, free, we have to cool down these materials to critical temperature is fine. And it turns out stay within other limits of magnetic field and also the current that we're actually trying to push through. There are limits to that. But if we stay in those limits, we can do that very, very efficiently and almost lossless, right? And so they actually have done this. So they have produced superconducting high voltage wires. They've actually done a test case of at least one. I was trying to figure out how many of these might be out there, and there's at least one. And it's in Germany, and it's about a kilometer long wire, operates at 10 kilovolts, which is a little bit higher than a typical voltage line. You know, often they're in like the, you know, I think around 1 to 10 or something. But the current that they run is quite high, 2,300 amps. The idea being, if we could get a room temperature or even higher than that critical temperature, man, we could push power like anywhere.
We don't have to sustain
it. Not have these ohmic losses, these joule heatings. If you don't know it, a lot of power lines heat up in service and that's loss. That's inefficiency.
Yeah.
So we want to try to avoid that if possible. But as you can imagine, it's kind of challenging to produce these cables and maintain these cables in these cold states and so forth.
You might be asking yourself, like, where are we in terms of how close are we to a room temperature superconductor? I've seen like 130 Kelvin Right. We're going to go Kelvin, not Fahrenheit right now.
Yeah. And if you want 300 is like an okay number to think about for room temp. Yeah.
And so we can get even higher than 130 with high pressure situations too, but that's a
but
situation
it's insanely
where,
high pressure.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that's one of the cases where it's like you have to add something else to the system to sustain it. And at that point you're not,
right.
It's
just,
not
you
sustainable.
You can't do it outside of a lab. Yeah.
Yeah.
And for a large sample, it's impossible.
Tim mentioned MRI machines. That's one of the huge applications.
So this gets to the other
applications,
yeah. So not only for conductivity, but for creating high magnetic fields. Mm-hmm. And so this ability to produce high single digit and beyond double digit like Tesla fields, like for MRI, et cetera, that's another really big application for these. And we use them already in MRI machines.
Yeah, we measure brain waves with superconductors. There's a device called a SQUID or superconducting quantum interference device. I don't know if this is not the same thing as an MRI, right?
It's not quite the same, yeah.
So superconductors, you can separate two superconductors with an insulator, but the electrons from the two superconductors can interact through this layer, through physics that might be beyond the scope here, can essentially detect magnetic fields 100 billion times smaller than what would be considered a fridge magnet. So that's another way we can map brain activity because your brain is inducing magnetic fields.
Right. And they have a SQUID at the Ames lab, actually.
Oh, really?
At least one, or they did when I was working there. Yeah.
And then another one that comes to mind for a superconductor application is one that actually is in use. Cell towers have to contest right now with high numbers of signals, right? So, and as the speed of data transfer increases on our cellular devices and the number of cell phone users increase, we have to be able to create filters, which utilize superconductors in cell towers to make sure that what I'm doing on my phone doesn't contest with what Nate's doing on his phone and differentiate these signals and continue to send the same traffic to the same device. So
that's cool. That's really cool. I didn't know that.
One last application that at least I really enjoyed was using more of the magnetic applications of it is I think in Japan, I want to say, they're using this idea of the magnetic repulsion on like almost levitating high-speed trains to where there's no friction at all.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess you have to worry about, you know, those cold temperatures or how can we raise it up to room temperature? But that's another cool one that I look forward to seeing.
Trains levitating. When people hear levitating, they're like, put it on a vehicle immediately. So that's the one that comes to mind. Absolutely. But maglev.
I was just thinking about, you're just saying that was really cool. And I was thinking like, well, by definition, like superconductors are cool.
They have to be cool.
Literally, irrefutable. They are cool.
Right, until the room temperature is discovered. Yes, they are cool. Tim, quick question. Room temperature, superconductivity, like, do you see that happening? We had news about this thing called LK99 last fall. Did you hear about this at all?
Maybe.
You probably didn't hear about it because you're good at dodging misinformation.
Yeah, okay.
A lab got a room temperature, quote unquote, room temperature superconductor. Everybody called CAP. They tested it out for themselves. Nobody could repeat those results. They called it off as maybe impurities in the material or something else. But needless to say, like, there are teams out there working on this, trying to achieve this, and clearly getting close as we push these temperatures. And also, when we said high temperature superconductors earlier, it's still low temperatures. High temperature superconductors are above like 300, below zero Fahrenheit. So it's still incredibly cold, but we call them high temperatures because it's relative to low temperature superconductors.
Right. And
so
if you're interested,
ways off.
I think there's a really good plot that's kind of maintained on Wikipedia, and it kind of shows over time the different competitive materials and kind of the by year, the critical temperatures, and also they put on the high pressure cases as well. You can kind of see that trend.
Do you see it leveling off here, or is it kind of?
It's a great question. I mean, I really hope that we can find one at room temp, but I think it's going to be really challenging, and I think there's going to maybe be some other caveat, like, oh, the element we need is like super
rare
or difficult or expensive, or it requires some kind of fancy heat treatment that's like not effective.
It's not scalable.
Scalable. Somehow it winds up. That's kind of my guess for like if there's going to be one, maybe like the first one is going to be something or is a little caveat, but we've overcome a lot in material science and done things that seem like quite impossible.
Yeah.
And this is also kind of in the realm of physics, but who knows? I hope so.
Now, if I can dribble in one last like piece of mystery into the hunt for high temp superconductors before we leave. High temp superconductors use a different method to gain that superconductivity, essentially. Like the BCS theory, the low temperature superconductivity Cooper pair explanation, does not apply to high temp superconductors. And we don't yet know how the high temp superconductors work. So that's the other piece of this here, is we are hunting for room temp and trying to still explain this second high temperature piece here. So it's possible that once we discover that quote unquote room temp, and we start to, you know, maybe use supercomputers to model this electron activity and understand the what's happening to induce superconductivity at room temp, then we can apply that to other materials that might be more scalable and cheaper or in more abundance.
I heard ceramics are also a very big contender. Now, mm-hmm. I'm sure this is very much up your alley, but by using ceramics as the superconducting materials, you look at the brittleness, and a lot of our common uses for electricity is, you know, wrapping wire around stuff. So
bend a ceramic.
This is kind of going back to what I was saying. In that case, it would be like kind of a property trade-off, like, oh, it's this material. Oh, yeah, but like there's no way to make that into any reasonable shape, you know. Couple quick comments. So I think if people are interested and want to dive a little bit deeper into type 2, which are typically the higher temperature superconductors, if they look up something called vortex states, there's a little bit of information out there, I'm sure, that you might find interesting. Another thing I was going to say was, thank you for that comment about ceramics. Also, one of my undergraduate specialties as a student here a long time ago. The materials that are superconducting, that are, you know, what we would call, like, maybe we'll say, you know, right now they're high, but, you know, 150K or whatever, they're lousy conductors. They're terrible. If you're above the critical temperature, they're not conductive at all.
Oh, like
they're lousy. They're ceramics. Like they're excellent insulators. They're some of the best insulators all the way down to the critical temperature. And then bam,
all of a sudden
they're the best. Yeah. They're literally the best crazy conductors. It's just like that incredible change is pretty profound. And I think it would be worthwhile to mention. Yeah.
Yeah. I think we have to wrap it up about now.
That was a good run. I think we accomplished a lot there.
We really
that was
a lot of information. Lot. Yeah. The one thing that's sometimes tough in this hour is to, like, you know, last time me and Nate recorded an episode a couple weeks ago, not the previous one we recorded earlier today, we recorded for like an hour 45 and we cut that thing down to 55. Cause it's like, you just kind of have to take time to understand where your main points are and stuff like that. But with superconductors, 2 weeks ago when I was deciding on episode topics, I was like, look, we're recording two in one day. I need something kind of light. But superconductors, there's so much to unpack and so much like meat to it and so much excitement about it too, which is what made this very fruitful. Got to run through our thank yous. Tio, thanks for the music. You can go check out his stuff on Spotify. He does our intro and break stuff or whatever. I'm actually realizing we didn't do a break. Check out our description to hear more from him. Check out our Instagram, also in the description, so you're not missing out on any of our between episode content and hearing our updates and whatnot. You can also join, I forgot to mention this last episode, I have a Instagram broadcast channel you can find on our main page called Pocket Science Studio. That's where we give the super behind the scenes stuff on all our episodes. So there's a lot of stuff there that you will only find there. Go ahead and tap in. Remember, degree or not, if you're listening to this podcast, you are part of an international group of scientists, 100 in countries and counting. So thanks for being here and chatting with us. Hopefully we inspired you to go learn a little bit more about superconductors. And of course, thanks Nate for being here. Dr. Cullinan, thanks again.
Great being here. This is
my pleasure. Thank you.
Yeah, that's about all we have. We'll see you again in 2 weeks, people. Peace out.
Peace.
Goodbye.
Ignition sequence starts. 3, 2, 1. Liftoff. We have a liftoff.